Good morning. So, thank you all very much for coming. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'm really delighted to be here. My name is Tim Brewer. I'm the Director of Global Health Programs for the Faculty of Medicine at McGill University, and I'm thrilled to have you here. It's been a little bit of a challenge putting this together. As I was telling Michael Johnson last night, we've had to deal with we lost a speaker to H1N1, not that she caught it, but she's fighting it. Michael had to battle thunderstorms to get here, and just a series of things, but it's all, we are here now, and we're going forward, and that's truly, truly wonderful. I'm really delighted, in addition to our outstanding McGill speakers, we have some people from the outside and some people from the University of Montreal as well. And I'm looking forward, as I'm sure you are, to hear about the incredibly exciting work that's going on the other side of the mountain. So I'm really delighted to have them here and really appreciate their making the long trek over the big mountain. I wanted to share with you briefly how I view global health. And I tend to think of things in numbers because I'm an epidemiologist. So 30 billion, 10.4 million, 4,250,000, 132,471, 202, 56%, and 2.5%. And for me, that encapsulates global health. In 2003, the SARS epidemic cost an estimated $30 billion in direct and indirect costs. Every year, 10.4 million children under the age of 5 die, primarily of preventable diseases. Worldwide, in 2006, the World Health Organization estimated that there's a shortage of physicians, nurses, and midwives to the tune of 4.3 million healthcare workers. And in the United States in 2005, Dr. Fitzmaughan did a study where he estimated that there were 132,471 physicians who were trained in low-resource settings who were practicing in the United States and Canada. 202 is the number of pigs in Clearwater County that they estimate have been infected with H1N1 from humans, even though it was originally called swine flu. 56% of adults over the age of 15 in sub-Saharan Africa in 2002 died of infectious diseases. The corresponding number in North America was 2.5%. And together, these numbers encapsulate for me how I think about the challenges that we're dealing with. And part of why I think we can grapple with some of these very difficult issues is partnerships. And that's what we're going to be focusing on today. And we're going to hear about a variety of different types of partnerships across a spectrum of disciplines. So you're going to hear from law and parasitology and medicine and social sciences. And we all come at partnerships a little bit differently, but underlying all of the partnerships, I think, is that common theme of working together to address problems that challenge all of us. So it's not us helping them, it's us working together to deal with mutual problems. And these are really problems that affect all of us. I'm really delighted to start the day with having Dr. Gerald Kirsch give our morning keynote session. It's hard to think of enough superlatives when introducing Gerald Kirsch. He's been the former director of the Fogarty Center at the National Institutes of Health. He was the chief of infectious diseases at New England Medical Center. He's a world-renowned researcher with over, I believe it's 300 publications in diarrheal disease and a variety of infectious diseases, and is now the associate provost at Boston University, where he's in charge of thinking about how the university as a whole should be interacting in global health. And it's one really the true leaders in the field of global health. So I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Kirsch.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's a great pleasure to be here. I want to ultimately address this morning in the hour and a half that I have. to talk about whether academia is relevant to global health. So what I'm going to try to do is to do a little bit of scene setting. I think for most people in this room, you're the committed already, so I've just selected a few highlights. I'm going to ask where we've come from, where we're now, where we're going, something about partnerships, and then end with a brief comment about intended and, more importantly, unintended consequences of our actions. So we know that health disparities exist, and they're quantitative. They can be measured. These are data from the United States, and if you look at life expectancy by race, that does not represent significant biological differences. We know that health disparities are also qualitative. This is a very nice study from the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S., the Institute of Medicine, in 2001. And some of the disparities that occur through the operation of the healthcare system and the legal and regulatory climate that allows people to get or not get care, and then all the discrimination, bias, prejudice, stereotyping that exists in all societies, and we must come to deal with it. So in the United States, we have some significant problems with disparities in healthcare, in access, and in outcomes, which we need to address. But we also know that disparities are related to poverty, and this is an interesting set of data going back to the turn of the previous century, plotting life expectancy against income per capita, GDP measured in a standardized international monetary unit. And it doesn't matter whether it's the beginning of the 20th century or the end of the 20th century, what you find is that the lowest life expectancy clusters at the lowest GDP. And the other important thing for countries like the United States and Canada is that as you get richer and richer, it doesn't add very much, but we do spend a lot more on our healthcare system, gaining relatively little for the expenditure. It's also striking that life expectancy, as one of those aggregate measures of health status in a population, can be sharply affected by particular diseases. So these are data from five countries in sub-Saharan Africa, plotting the gains in life expectancy at birth during this period of time, and then they suddenly and sharply drop. And we all know what that is all about. And that's the advent of widespread transmission of HIV and its mortality. And the younger you are when you die, the greater an impact it has on life expectancy. In the past, life expectancy at birth has been, by and large, determined by whether or not you live in the first 5 years. If you survive that period of time, you're likely to live, and that gives you the higher number. This was very striking because, as you know, people in their adult productive lives were the target of this disease. So not only did it alter life expectancy, it had huge impact on economics, the family structure, and has been hugely disruptive. It's not getting better for those who are at the very bottom of the barrel. So if we look at 38 least developed countries compared to high-income countries and some of the better-off low-income countries with this sort of number of population, 600 million, 1.7 billion, almost a billion here, annual income going from $300 per capita to $23,000 per capita. This comes from the report from the World Health Organization from the Commission on Macroeconomics and Health, which if you haven't read it, is still a relevant document to read. It's available on the web. Life expectancy ranged from 49 to 77, infant mortality from 103 to 6. So these striking differences and very much related to income and what income buys. And so if that's your reality, what do you wish for? What do you want in your fortune cookie? You want to get money to build your healthcare system. And maybe that's why it's called a fortune cookie. So let's go back a little bit. Where have we come from? That's the setting of global health disparities. And I didn't feel I needed to go into it in any great detail because I think you have some good sense of that. The last century was quite remarkable. It was a hugely successful century in terms of medical science and successes. We developed imaging. We went from the X-ray to MRIs and other similar technologies. We developed new sciences like immunology. Didn't exist before 1896 or so when antibodies were used to demonstrate that a pathogen isolated from an individual actually was the cause because you could show a rise in antibodies. We developed new vaccines going from polio to HPV. These were now based not just on the very simple Pasteur problem, take a bug, grind it up, kill it, inject it, sometimes doing as much harm as good. We eradicated a pathogen from the face of the earth, except a few freezers in Atlanta and several places in the Soviet Union. So smallpox should be gone. We don't know how much it's proliferated and could potentially now be a weapon. But a remarkable success. We absolutely eradicated natural transmission and existence of this pathogen so that it only was in test tubes and freezers. We realized that there were behavioral risk factors, that it's not all biology. And we've started to take some steps to address that. Tobacco and diet, good examples. We went from pathology, which is the dead meat subject, to molecular and cellular biology, and incorporated pathology in a new fashion. We identified receptors and signaling and realized that there's all this conversation going on between cells and between molecules. We created the genetic sciences. No longer was it just Mendel. And we sequenced the human genome, and we've sequenced the multiplicity of microbial genomes. And that has led us into the era of the omics, which has brought us into systems biology. We're moving into bionics, and we now are starting to see the first of the designer drugs. At the same time, the very same century, full of disappointments, we've had these increasing disparities in health. We've discovered, and part of your challenge in global health, is that we fail to use available technology. On the research side, we have increasing disparities. We're spending huge amounts of money on the diseases that affect primarily the smallest number of the world's population. And there's a reason why neglected diseases are called neglected. They're not only neglected in terms of trying to address them, but they're also quite neglected in terms of research expenditures. We've learned that knowledge is not sufficient. It doesn't equal problem solving. There's a whole set of social and sociological factors that need to be considered. And as a result of some of these things, there are more people affected by neglected diseases now than ever before. We've also seen the rise over the last century of a for-profit pharmaceutical industry that has a fiduciary responsibility, like it or not, to its stockholders and must have some sense of the business bottom line when it invests in research and development. So if we said, let's invent a pharmaceutical industry to address the needs in global health, would we make it a for-profit private industry? Maybe not. On the other hand, having served in the government of the United States for 5 years, I'm convinced that the government can't do it. would really muck it up. And I don't think academia really would develop drugs. So we may have the best and the worst of all possible solutions at the present time, and we need to figure out how do we change it so the impact on access, availability, affordability, the appropriateness and the acceptability of the products of our science is actually on target and reaches people. But the profit motive, on the other hand, pushes the drug companies to perhaps pay excessive attention to lifestyle drugs. And as a consequence of that, for most of the pharma industry, there's been inattention to the neglected tropical diseases. There's also a great dilemma in public health. A significant part of what global health is all about is public health. Public health is the art and science of making sure nothing happens. When nothing happens, does anybody notice? Politicians worry when nothing happens. Nothing is a political vacuum, and there's nothing that politicians like less than a political vacuum. So when you ask them to pay for the public health system, they say, why? When they pay H1N1, and the story isn't over yet, when they pay, nothing happens, they get angry about it. When they balk or they get angry, the public health system suffers until something happens. And when something happens, everybody is blamed, especially the public health system and its failed leadership who misled the poor politicians. So it's a catch-22 conundrum. And in part of this, as part of this, the expenditures in public health are shockingly low. In the United States, less than 5% of healthcare can be considered to be spent on real public health. That is a huge dilemma. If you think that you're in public health, you have this, it's even bigger than the mountain for the other university to get across. We have to cross that mountain and make sure that public health is understood for what it really is. So where are we now? Now, you know this painting. This is Gauguin's Where Have We Been, Where Are We Now? And Où allons-nous? Where are we going? The present global context is a bit scary. We have extensive poverty. Billions live on less than $2 a day. And health expenditures in those countries are woefully, woefully inadequate. Population continues to grow. As a result of that, in part, environment is continually being degraded, and it leads to things like climate change and pollution and disease spread. Civil society is in a mess. We continue to see civil and foreign wars, genocides, displaced persons, refugees, migration, amidst a whole set of failed states, some of which had huge resources and have squandered them. 95% of the global disease burden is in developing countries, and the expenditures to meet them are inadequate. And the research gap, the so-called 1090 gap, is part of that context. But something's happened in the last 10 or 15 years. We've begun to recognize the importance of global issues in a way that we had not before. It's not just about foreign policy and conquest. Globalism is the 21st century theme. We need to figure out what's the appropriate response to the changing world. And one of the wonderful things that we have seen, and I suspect you have seen here as well, is a change in social consciousness of students. And students now driving academic institutions to do better than they have. As a part of this, we've realized that health is one of those key global concerns. You can't have economic development if you have an unhealthy population. We've also come to think of health as a human right. Unfortunately, passing laws that say health is a human right doesn't seem to change a heck of a lot, so we have to be very pragmatic. And on the pragmatic side, starting to think about health as a security issue. It's important for North America, for African states to be stable, which depends on their health. It becomes a security issue for us, and if that's the way to unleash some effective support, so be it. And it's central to all aspects of international policy because it is a core aspiration of all nations. And we're beginning to learn that health is one of those key drivers of soft diplomacy, how you make change in the world through improving health and making those investments. The essential premise to all of this is that surrounding at the center of all of these various sectors is health. Health is the only one of these that I think is germane to every one of the ring around it. So health is central. We can feel secure as health professionals that we're onto the right thing. If we could fix health, we could fix the world. So what is global health? Tim Brewer is part of a group that's creating a consortium of universities that are trying to effectively address global health issues. And one of our colleagues, Jeff Copeland from Emory, has worked on a definition for global health. What does it mean? What is it? And this is a trial balloon, and this is part of a paper that is in the process of being published, so I pulled it out of the paper, and I am illegally showing it to you, so soon after you see this slide, forget it. Think about global health as a field of study, research, and practice. So it's broadly encompassing. And it places priority on improving health and achieving equity. That's what we like to do in public health for all people worldwide. It emphasizes transnational health issues, determinants, and/or solutions, involves multiple disciplines, that's important, within and beyond the health sciences, and promotes interdisciplinary collaboration, and is a synthesis of population-based prevention with individual-level clinical care. So we're not saying it's public health versus individual care. It encompasses the whole system, which is the challenge. How do we practice good global health? It demands an enormous amount from us. Unless things change dramatically, where are we likely to go in the 21st century? There'll be more old people and more young people. There'll be more poor people and more hungry people. There will be more crowding, there will be more pollution, people will move into urban areas, the slums will have no services, the environment will continue to be degraded, there will be more discrepancy in the access to resources. This breeds resentment, political instability and violence, social disruption, failed states, and terrorism. That's the scenario if we don't do anything. So the question is, if the premise is correct that health is at the center, and if we don't do something about health, the rest of the sectors are not going to move in the direction that they need to, how can we improve health, reduce disparities in the places where it exists to its greatest extent? Well, first of all, you got to figure out what the problems are. And that implies a need for not just basic research, which is where we've been for decades, but applied research down in the trenches and the translation between the basic and the applied. We have to, not only can, we have to involve our students as well as our faculty, and we have to get out of our ivory towers and into the field, and we have to get out of the hospitals and the health clinics into the community. That's not enough. Used to be enough. You could write a paper, advance your career. But now the challenge is to identify what are the possible solutions, whether they are in facilities or in the community, and to be sure that they are culturally appropriate to the society in which you're working. And then the challenge is implement interventions. And this implies money and people, and it has to apply equally to capacity building of partners that you work with. Now, if you don't know the World Development Report from 1993, you should, and you should get it out and take a look at it, because It is one of those transforming studies that the World Bank has produced, and particularly relevant for university global health programs. It was called Investing in Health. No longer was putting money in health, pouring money down a black hole, and a cost. Now it was an investment in future development. And the most unanticipated finding in the report, Dean Jameson was the lead author, Larry Summers was the chief economist at the bank at the time, and Dean tells the story of Larry inviting him into his office before the study was going to be published. And Dean was prepared to talk about what they had found, and Larry Summers said, "I don't care about anything else. Tell me what's the most important unanticipated thing you found in your study." And the most unimportant and anticipated finding was that knowledge drove development. Knowledge and research and application in health. That changed the way the World Bank started to operate. Now, I don't think anybody is particularly satisfied with the way the bank has, in fact, worked. But there is a watershed between where it was before 1993 World Health Report and where it is now, and it's moved in a very interesting direction. Well, what do universities do? We have four critical roles as academics. We educate, and there is a responsibility to educate the public at large. Unfortunately, in many institutions, education, the quality of education, may be relegated to second place, and particularly in research-intensive institutions. Research and research income drives some of the decision-making, and quality of education is not as highly concerned, higher enough concern. We do research. It is the generation of new knowledge. We do service. That's in part in the translation, the application of knowledge in society. Some do it better than others. And if universities are not involved in policy formation, they should. We should be informing the political sector, and we should be influencing decision-making. What do we do in this new era of globalization as a university? I think we have to teach global literacy. I think a student in a school of management or a business school needs to understand the magnitude of the disparities in health as much as science students need to understand the practical value of their work, and all students need to know about the real world that they live in. No longer is ignorance of geography and what that implies acceptable. If you graduate from a university and you're ignorant about the rest of the world that you live in, your university has failed you, and it's a failed institution. So I think we ought to make global health studies a required part of a core curriculum at every university, for every undergraduate. We can and we should engage in the improvement of kindergarten to grade 12 education in science and technology. And we should, as academics, be sure that we promote public access to the health literature. That means that publication in open source journals, open access journals. We should find venues to publish things that don't work because there are enough lessons to learn from what doesn't work as there is from what does work. And we should speak to the public, and we should speak in plain language. Researchers' knowledge creation can be upstream, downstream, or maybe should be all the way up and down the stream. So if we embrace a culture of science, a global culture of science, have high ethical standards with open and free communication, we will necessarily have a concern for the development of global public goods, those things that should be accessible to everybody. We need to promote interdisciplinary research. We need to connect basic and applied research. We need to reward research productivity by faculty through recognition, support, and academic promotions when they do applied research. In many institutions, it is very hard to get promoted if you do applied research. It's not considered significant and serious enough. We have to change that culture. And as part of that, as a university, when we do make discoveries that are relevant, we have to have a socially relevant policy for how we deal with intellectual property and licensing, because knowledge is one of those global public goods. Similarly, in service and policy development, we, as part of our activities globally, need to contribute to capacity building, and that's in science and clinical medicine, public health. We need to support training of colleagues from the developing world. We should be working more effectively with international agencies. Globalization is not all bad. There are good aspects to it, and we should promote those, and we should fight the and correct the bad side. And we should enter the national policy decision-making process. Part of that is what the University Consortium for Global Health tries to do, National Academy of Sciences, Institute of Medicine and its studies, and we should not be embarrassed by being advocates. So now I'll come to the substance of my talk. So I was asked to talk about building health partnerships between developed and developing country universities, but we need to modify that a little bit because you have to throw in the word sustainable and effective. What are the essential features of sustainable, effective partnerships? So the traditional business model is, you know, you make a deal and you shake hands over it. Public health is a little more creative and innovative and down in the trenches, in a sense. Wrong direction. There's a very important paradigm that Bob Klitgaard, who's, I think, just stepped down as the president of Claremont University and previously was at the RAND Corporation. He says global governance has to change from the past where it was layer cake. And that meant to him that the tasks were taken on separately by the different sectors to marble cake. Cross-sectoral partnerships. In research, we call it interdisciplinarity. And that kind of interdisciplinarity in research and interdisciplinarity or marble cake governance is where we need to go. We can't stovepipe the various sectors. They have to interact. And so Klitgaard says if you're trying to deal with partnerships, three key questions have to be addressed. First one is for the partners to say, what's in it for me or my institution? There's nothing wrong about it. Both partners need to ask that question. You have to ask, what is my partner going to contribute? Because if the partner doesn't contribute, it's not a partnership. And then there are real costs, and you have to say, what will it cost me? And you can't be selective. We can't buy the entire concept, Mr. Hood, but that part about taking from the rich has potential. We have to be broad and clearly interactive. So there are three essential features for universities engaging in a partnership. The first is that you must establish a condition of trust between you and your partner. You have to ask those three questions, and you have to figure out how you're going to trust each other. The second one is, how are you going to trust each other? And you can guess what the third one is. How can you trust? Can you trust one another? There's, I think, three essential attitudes. You have to have mutual respect. Absolutely. So trust and respect. Trust and respect. And trust and respect. So you can't emphasize these points enough. And that's the very basis of the enabling features for successful partnership, which is establishing a relationship. If you don't have a relationship, if you come in like the greatest invention of all time because you're a rich Western university, you have no trust, and you cannot develop a relationship. So if there's any set of points that are relevant to taking an approach, given the background, the history of where we are, where we've been, where we are now, and where we think we need to go. We need to build these institutional relationships, and they're based on people, on individuals. Who your ambassador is really matters. That individual has to be able to create an environment of trust and has to actually feel and emanate respect. So what can we do as academics? Well, we can do simple things like use open access journals. We can work on developing sustained collaborations with scientists in the developing world for training research and improving the clinical services. But it has to be in a way that they improve the clinical services. If you parachute in your medical students or your residents and you say, we're doing a great thing, you're only doing a fragment of a great thing. You're actually displacing people from what they ought to be doing better. We should advocate within the institution for better and more enlightened technology transfer policies, which means that as scientists and health professionals, we actually need to understand what intellectual property and tech transfer is all about. Maybe a little bit of a pain, but part of the academic curriculum needs to educate scientists in what that means. And we should be organized and become vocal advocates for appropriate assistance to developing countries for capacity building and service. So, as you may know, the Obama administration announced a large initiative in global health earlier in the week. Some of us thought this was in addition to the $45 billion or so for the AIDS program. It now looks like it encompasses the AIDS program. And so some of us will be working to make sure that there's something beyond AIDS. HIV is not the only problem that needs to be addressed. And as Canadians, as good Canadians, you could and should work with IRDC, which is, in the world of government-related development centers, an inherently good agency. And I very much like its tagline, which is Science for Humanity. What can the institutions do? What can we push our institutions to do? We can value applied research in career development. I said this before. And one of those might be to work on rapid, low-tech, low-cost diagnostics. So if you didn't find the $10 bill in your fortune cookie, you might have the diagnosis. In order to do this, we need to change the way we think about our faculty. And if you're doing risky research, by nature, you're going to fail. Our promotion systems are all based on success. If you fail all the time because you're doing things out on the edge that have potential huge fallout and could create all kinds of new things, as long as you're not really a lousy researcher, and that's why everything fails, so there needs to be some judgment, we need to have some professorships for risky science or, make it a little more dramatic, failed experiments. We've got to push that envelope. We've got to be pushing out there. And if we can do all of that, we'll have some of the intended consequences. We'll progress towards this more integrated partnership model that I talked about. We'll see capacity improvements happen in our partners. We'll address some of the managerial incompetence, which is some of the greatest gap that exists now. We'll be able to help improve governance. Of course, we should look at our own house as well about transparency and what's fair and what's ethical and what is actually corruption. We will get some meaningful health benefits from it. And we'll find that the learning and the lessons learned become bidirectional. We'll learn as much as we think we're teaching. The unintended consequences. There's always the danger of neocolonialism. The power is not symmetrical. We in the first world, we call ourselves the first world because we have the power to do so and the economic resources to do so. And it often comes down to an issue of who's in control. There's too much introduction of inappropriate technology. Not that populations in the developing world don't deserve the very best, but the very best is very costly and doesn't necessarily buy you very much. So we need to be thinking of what's appropriate. We may displace the concern of our partners from their local problems to hosting international students. I've seen this happen in places, and I suspect Tim has as well. And we think we're doing a great thing because we're sending hordes of students to this place, and they don't have the capacity to handle them. And however good it is for our students, it's equally as bad for the place we're sending them. So we need to exert some judgment, and that's why the capacity building becomes even more important. There are often cultural clashes, and some of that will come around the control issues. We may come with a bias of a focus on the facilities, because it's easier to work in a hospital or a health center. It's harder to get out in the community, and too few of us know what anthropology is all about. And we may have a research dominance simply because of the leadership role. Who's the PI? Who got the money? How does it play out in terms of authorship or presentation of data and the building of capacity? So ultimately, can we deliver what we promise? It will depend on having resources. So here's good old McGill and his partner. Could be the other way around, of course, and probably will in the next decade or two. And McGill is saying, I think I can make you very happy if I can get funded. So part of our responsibility is going to be generating the resources to make all of these good things happen. But it's not. It's not impossible, and I think we can do it. So I'll end very quickly, and maybe I should end right here, but I'll go ahead anyway. Here we are today. Some of you may have seen this circulating on the Internet, and it's obviously been stimulated by the current H1N1, which really isn't a swine disease. It's really a human disease. So Pooh and Piglet are walking along, and as the two friends wandered through the snow on their way home, Piglet grinned to himself, thinking how lucky he was to have a best friend like Pooh. And that's today. We're all in this together, you know. We're really partners and friends. And then something like H1N1 comes along, and suddenly we backslide, and Pooh thinks to himself, if the pig sneezes, he's fucking dead. So there needs to be a personal commitment which translates into an institutional persistence and focus on what the real problems are and what universities can contribute to problem solving. Thank you.
Any questions at all?
Good. Success.
Here we go. Yeah.
I should have known. It's on.
Martin Bitson from Children's Hospital McGill. Thank you very much for this humorous and excellent presentation. You brought one aspect, and I think one should elaborate a little bit. About parachuting students into facilities or healthcare environments where they may cause unintended harm. And it's a big discussion, probably worthwhile a whole morning to discuss. But what is your perspective? How could students indeed, or medical residents, gain some experience and insight without causing harm?
It is a lot easier to point out the problem, which many neglect to think about, than it is to solve the problem. I think there's a couple of aspects to it. One is number and proportion. If there is a rising demand from students, from undergraduates through to students in the health professionals to get out into the field. And on the medical side, we tend to think about facilities. And facilities, you've been in places. You've got hundreds and hundreds of people showing up at an outpatient clinic. they're just hordes, and there are relatively busy local docks. There may be language issues where you don't know the language, and you suddenly dump a number of students on in a partnership in which your developing country partner feels responsible to take care of your students. And I'm afraid that in some of those instances, what's already in short supply, which is attention to those patients' needs, becomes even shorter. So if we're sending students who need supervision, we should be sending faculty. And if we're sending students and faculty, we should pair them with students and faculty from the host institution. And we should build rather than dump our students on them. We should also be distributive. You can't send 100 students to one institution at a time and expect the institution to cope with it. We should be getting our students out into the field. There's a whole range of things that we can do. It's harder. It takes more time and energy on the part of our planners here to make that happen there. I know, I think it's paying attention to those sorts of details. And one final, just quick thought, is that our students need to be better prepared when they go. It's not just, a lecture or a seminar on cultural relevance and cultural competence. We do that, in dealing with immigrant populations in our own settings. We should do it in a much more extended manner. If we had global health literacy running through our curriculum, that problem would go away. So you could solve those two things for everybody, not just the health professionals who might go abroad. So I think that's the kind of thinking that one needs to engage in. The worst thing of all is not thinking about it at all.
We'll take one more question, and then we'll move on.
What role do the diaspora, the health workers in the developed world, play in these health outcomes? How to get them engaged in this process?
So in case you didn't hear, the question is, what role do diaspora health workers play in this? And it could be an extremely important one because at the very base, they come from the culture. They should understand it. They have the language competency, and can be effective partners. And there are groups in the area around Boston. Our Indian, not Native American, but Indian from India population, many in private practice, have begun to come together, generate some money, spend some time back in their home, sharing the knowledge that they have developed in the course of their diaspora lives. Many of them left to get out of the culture, and so they don't want to re-enter it, but many still have ties. If you can link them effectively with the academic sector and not leave them just hanging as a small, minimally impactful NGO, I think you can enlist more of them more effectively, and those may be the faculty mentors that you want to send with your students. So when you are in an international city like Montreal is or like Boston is, you have the opportunity to try to build that kind of coalition, and it goes along with the response to the previous question.
Well, again, I'd like to thank Dr. Kirsch for an outstanding start to the day. And at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Greg Matlashewski, the chairman of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at McGill, who's going to chair the next panel.